Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Twin sisters, alone, by then widowed, traveled by camel across a barren desert in the Sinai Peninsula of the 19th century Egypt to the remote St. Catherine's Monastery, where they discovered the oldest translation of the four Gospels dating from the mid-5th century. This is not the plot of the imagination, but the real-life story of two Scottish sisters. Janet Soskis has written the story of their amazing lives, The Sisters of Sinai, How Two Lady Adventurers Discovered the Hidden Gospels. And Janet, she's a professor in philosophical theology at the University of Cambridge, is with us today to talk about the story and her own discoveries in writing it. Thanks for joining us, Janet.
Oh, thank you.
You can't put too fine a point on the whole adventurers idea. I mean, once I started reading the book, I couldn't put it down because it was something out of a movie or something.
Well, it really is amazing, and particularly
epic.
Coming from a tiny, tiny town on the west coast of Scotland, how they found it in themselves to do what they did is really quite extraordinary.
Exactly. So tell us, why don't we talk about first that central discovery that made them so famous, at least a household word name among the scholars who studied such things at the time?
Well, as your lead-in said, when they were both widowed, they'd long wanted, there's a background of travel here that mm-hmm. we'll get to. But when they were, the second one was widowed, they were twins, they wanted to fulfill a long ambition to go to St. Catherine's Monastery in the Sinai. And this was built on what is, putatively the site of the burning bush where God spoke to Moses and told him to go and free the Israelites from their Egyptian captivity. And the burning bush was a symbol of the Presbyterian Church. They were devout Presbyterians. And you've got to imagine, for children growing up in Dour, Scotland, in the 19th century, tales of the Old Testament were terribly stirring and exciting, these picture book stories mm-hmm. of pharaohs and markets and iridescent diamonds that are traded and so on. So they had this mystique of the East, which a lot of people had, but they had also acquired a number of languages, including Arabic, and modern Greek, which very few people spoke. And they sent out in their way to do this. This involved going to Cairo, and you had to hire a guide, and the guide had to hire Bedouin camel drivers and camels, say 15 camels, to carry all your stuff, because it's a 10-day crossing. Then you have to have provisions for the stay at the monastery, because there's not enough food there to support visitors.
And they had provisions for 40 days.
Yes, they had provisions for 40 days, carried on their camels, living chickens in crates on the back of these camels, and water, of course, for themselves and the camels. But the thing is that they had discovered that the monastery was very famous amongst the Bible-believing public, which was virtually everyone, in the English-speaking world at this time, as the place where the oldest known copy of the Gospels had been found, the Codex Sinaiticus, by a German scholar some 40 years earlier. And most people thought everything had been found there. But Agnes, the one who just had lost her husband, read that Tischendorf hadn't examined all the manuscripts in Syriac, which is basically the same as Aramaic, the language Jesus and the disciples spoke. And she became very excited about this, and in the interval between her husband's death and going, which is only 9 months, mm-hmm. she learned Syriac. She taught herself Syriac. And when they got out there, well, that story may come later, she asked to be shown these ancient Syriac manuscripts, and she was shown to a dark closet off a dark room, no lights at all, of course, underneath the archbishop's lodgings. And there were a lot of abandoned manuscripts and trunks, and she took them to the light of day and soon set upon this manuscript, all its pages stuck together, and it was a palimpsest. And that means that, the vellum or the animal skin on which had been written was so valuable that the monks at some stage had scraped it clean and written another text on top. And the upper writing of this was A Life of Woman Saints in Syriac, and Agnes could read that. But she could see peeping out above the top of each page, according to Matthew, according to Luke, and she reckoned there was a gospel beneath, and it must be very old. And she was right.
Now, there's so much backstory, and it's, to me, knowing the backstory is what makes it even more interesting, because, of course, there were two... They were uneducated, formally, formally uneducated, but absolutely brilliant, apparently. I don't know how people can be so self-taught as they were and not be. They were driven. They were impassioned. They were gifted people. Tell us about their upbringing, because a lot of it seemed to start with their father.
I think it really did. Their mother died. They were born on January 11th, 1843, so their birthday is coming up. And and the mother died giving birth to them, and they were the first and only children. And the father decided not to marry and raised them up himself. And he was a lawyer in this small town. Fairly prosperous, but the town was not at all prosperous, and he educated them pretty much as he would have done boys. You know, he didn't, a lot of people thought girls couldn't take too much mental stimulation, that it would, you know, destroy their womb and this kind of thing, but he didn't believe that. He thought they should be educated, and one of the best things he did, he discovered pretty early on that they were good at languages, and he made a pact with them that for every language they learned, he'd take them to the country of that language. So while they were still little girls, they learned French and Italian and German, you know, using each other as a kind of practice partner. And then they would have these wonderful holidays. So they early on, very few British people traveled to this stage. The decade they were born into, the 1840s, was actually the first decade of railroad travel. The railroads were being built. So they really benefited from this. And they formed this fixed association with travel as being a good broadening and associating with their father and their father's respect. And so when he died...
they were still quite young.
They were still quite young. An intervening interesting thing that happened is their father inherited a huge sum of money from a distant kinsman, money that had been made in America, and these various distant kinsmen dying without wills, and all this money ricocheting back to a fellow in their small town of Irvine. And in the will of this very rich guy left the twins' father a great deal of money. So when their father died, rather unexpectedly, they were 22, they were left very rich and entirely alone in the world. I mean, entirely alone. They had no other... Their father never spoke to them once about their mother, and as far as they knew, they had no other relations. So this was sad, but in a sense, great, because a lot of things that kept women from doing things in those days would be someone, an aunt or a cousin or an uncle, saying, oh, you couldn't possibly do that, even if they had the money and the wherewithal. But they just had a twin who's, well, I think we should do something. And they said, oh, yes. And so they decided in their bereavement, deep bereavement, when you're supposed to be all clad in black, they decided to go down the Nile. So they did that when they were in their mid-20s. And again, they didn't want to have a travel guide. The normal thing then would be to take a kind of a courier, who's kind of mobile travel guide, goes with you, makes your bookings and liaises with transport. But they said, you don't need one if you speak the languages, which they did. And they took... they had to have a chaperone, these are young unmarried ladies, so they took one of their former schoolmistresses, another Scottish lady, who was only 36, and these three young women went all across Europe, down the Danube to Constantinople, sailed across the Eastern Mediterranean, and down the Nile. So they're quite extraordinary. And that began, really, a life of travel for them.
They were gone about a year. If you're just joining us, my guest is Janet Saskis. She is the author of The Sisters of Sinai, How Two Lady Adventurers Discovered the Hidden Gospels. They weren't just dilettantes. They truly were adventurers.
Well, they were. And they gained a quick sense. They had this dictum, never go to a country where you don't speak the language.
Mm-hmm.
And it proved very right on their trip to Egypt, because the first time they went to Egypt, they didn't have Arabic, and they were really... comprehensively cheated by the guide, the dragoman that they hired there, who realized that he could blackmail them effectively. Well, not blackmail them. He could keep them from seeing anyone else.
Yeah, that was kind of odd.
Yes. Well, you see, he was cheating them. He was charging them a lot and offering them very little. And one of the charms of going on a Nile travel at this time was extremely rare. It was before organized travel, and only the substantially rich could do it, so it was really fashionable. The Prince of Wales had made a well-publicized Nile tour when the twins were just 19, and you had the impression that if you went on the Nile, although there'd be very few people on the Nile, they'd be really exciting plus rich, you know, and probably a good place to find a husband, to be honest, as frank about these ladies. And you had to, for instance, the travel guide, Murray's travel guide to the Nile, advised buying a small pistol for firing off, and this wasn't to warn people away. This was to call guests on other boats to dinner instead of a dinner gong, because a gong couldn't be heard on the Nile. And so they were, I think they were expecting a great time, but this dragoman kept them from meeting anyone because he said, oh, the people on that boat, they have the worst reputation and this and that. And so they were really, because they didn't speak Arabic, they were really swindled. And so after that, they decided to learn Arabic. And that began a long trip of learning languages, because they didn't marry till relatively late in life.
But they always wanted to. There was no question. They were such a combination of yearnings between them. The travel, the language, to become scholarly. They weren't just travelers. They were scholars about where they traveled.
Well, they were, yes. I mean, they weren't scholars. They became scholars in a really technical sense after this great find.
Yes.
But you know, they did their research, and they of course, in those days, if you were a well-educated person, fewer people were well-educated, but mm-hmm. well-educated people often, for instance, would have Greek to a very high level. Very few women did, but mm-hmm. Most men, American and British men, who'd, you know, from the educated groups, would have had a high degree of Greek. What they didn't have is spoken Greek. And when Agnes and Margaret decided, they moved after they came back to Scotland after this year away. You know, they were in a tiny village and it was a bit dull. They decided to move to London, which was kind of odd because they're intensely patriotic Scots, but the London they moved in Scottish circles, basically, and they learned Greek there. And they fell under the sway of this Professor Blackie from Edinburgh, who believed the best guide to the way ancient Greek should be spoken was the way modern Greek spoke Greek in Athens. And so the twins learned modern Greek. And this put them in great stead because very few, although a lot of English and Scottish men could read Greek, they couldn't speak it, but the twins could. So they made... Agnes had written a book about their trip down the Nile that had some successful reviews, and she wanted to write another trip, and they went to Greece, and she wrote another book on the basis of that. But in Greece, that was their first encounter with the Eastern Church, with the Eastern Orthodox Church, and you must imagine the Eastern Church is incredibly foreign to a Scottish Presbyterian mm-hmm. from the mm-hmm. 19th century, and probably everything that they don't really approve of, a lot of processions and rituals
right.
and chant. But they found that the Greek monks, I think they found that very few people would speak to them. They were traveling on horseback in remote parts of Greece, and you know, people weren't used to talking. A man certainly wouldn't approach two ladies traveling like this. So that they found the monks would speak to them, and they were interested in the Bible. So on this shared foundation, they formed quite a fondness for Greek Orthodox monks, which was to stand them in good stead again.
We're going to have to take a quick break. My guest is Janet Saskas. She is a professor at University of Cambridge. She's written a book. It is called Sisters of Sinai. And we will be talking about that more when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email to sign up for one of WOSU's e-newsletters. And be sure to watch This Emotional Life, a special three-part series which continues tonight at 9 on WOSU-TV. This Emotional Life explores ways to improve social relationships, learn to cope with depression and anxiety, and become more positive, resilient people. Experts share the latest science on what makes us tick and how we can find support for the emotional issues we all face. Catch This Emotional Life tonight at 9 on WOSU-TV. 22 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20. Cloudy skies today, a high of 25 degrees, a slight chance of some snow. Cloudy tonight, a low of 17, and then snow is likely on Thursday. You can expect 2 to 4 inches of accumulation Thursday afternoon and into the evening. All Sides continues on WOSU.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Janet Saskas. She is the author of The Sisters of Sinai, How Two Lady Adventurers Discovered the Hidden Gospels. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call. Have a question or comment. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Agnes, they would prepare for these trips very carefully because they were doing it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that was one way to learn about where they were going to go and be more educated by it.
That's right. They did. And there wasn't, you know, it's kind of hard to find out this knowledge. Very few people had traveled, there were some guidebooks, but in you had to be as well prepared as you could be, but then you had to roll with contingencies. And they did that very well. I mean, what strikes me is how flexible they were. They were broad-minded in every way, because to do this kind of travel in those days, you really had to be prepared for some pretty odd things to happen. And so they were well prepared and good observers, too, of where they went. And as I said, they didn't seem to have a lot of travelogues you get from travelers of this period. They're very dismissive of a lot of the people they meet. But there didn't seem to be that side in Agnes and Margaret. I mean, they didn't approve of everything, but, you know, they could really see, they admired the Muslims in it.
I was going to bring that up. I thought that was very interesting. Yeah. She wrote about it in her diary, or was it in one of the travelogues?
They kept diaries, and they kept quite detailed diaries. And, for instance, the first time they went down the Nile when they were 26, they went on horseback through Palestine, and they went to Jerusalem. And they were introduced to the wives of a sultan. I think this is a kind of thing that you could sort of arrange, you know. And they met these ladies, and eventually the sultan came in, and they had a kind of staggered conversation there and shared a cigarette, which I thought was quite interesting. And Agnes wrote down that while Muslim ladies, lack certain freedoms we have, you know, the veils at least keep their complexions very nice, and they're allowed to smoke cigarettes, which was quite a sort of shocking thing for her to write in the 1860s. But they also admired, they had various guides in the course of things. Some were Coptic Christians from Egypt, some were Muslims, some were from various Orthodox Christian sects in the East. They really made an effort to try to understand them. The Muslims they admired, because the Muslims didn't venerate icons, which they as Presbyterians heartily disapproved of, and because they seemed so devout and they really studied their scriptures. So it was very touching, the friendships that they made. They became very good friends with some of the monks who, you know, and they're still well remembered at the Monastery of St. Catherine, which is going much the same as it was 1,600 years ago in Sinai. And I think that's one of the fun things about writing the book, just discovering, because I was reading other 19th century travel accounts. And by contrast, Agnes and Margaret came out as really very broad-minded and open about things.
Very tolerant.
They
were very devout Presbyterians, however. Now, I shouldn't say however, as if they're mutually exclusive, but they were staunch Presbyterians.
Oh, they were. They were, you know... There were quite, of course, in Scotland in particular at the time, there were real extremes. There were some very great extremes. They were not, for instance, teetotal. They, on one of the accounts there, they got into a terrible storm at sea off the Bay of Biscay while they were sailing to Egypt and on one of their trips. And their chief worry was to secure a case of claret that was ricocheting across the floor of their cabin. And, they drank. They had nice dresses. They used to stop in later years on their way to Egypt. They would stop in Paris and buy frocks and bonnets, because another thing that's kind of surprising to me is when you did this kind of travel, if you're a woman, if you were staying in a hotel in Cairo or Alexandria, which you needed to do when you're provisioning, you were expected to dress for dinner. You mean you had to have formal wear and jewelry and hats and gloves, and you had to pack all that stuff and pack it through the desert with you afterwards. You know, there was no light suitcase for them. So they were devout Presbyterians. They believed very firmly, but they were also very open-minded, because one of the big things that was the issue there was the authority of Scripture. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the whole thing of, I think until the 19th century, most people hadn't really thought very much about the fact that until printing, all copies of the Gospels, all copies of the Bible were handwritten. What other way was there to do? In the course of transmission, many errors or deliberate transformations might have entered in. So going out, realizing, for instance, that there were about 3,000 different manuscripts of the New Testament, and no two were exactly the same. Mm-hmm. It was a really scary thought for a lot of people, but it didn't scare Agnes and Margaret, because they had the strong belief I think they had a stronger belief in the truth of Christianity, that it would triumph somehow, and that it could take the flak, I suppose. How would I say it? Something like that. That you shouldn't be afraid of the truth wherever it would lead you. I think that was very strong in them, and that was a religious and an intellectual principle for them. So, yes, they were conservative, but not benighted conservatives. Mm-hmm. They had read Darwin. They had read radical criticism, which most people of their generation wouldn't have done.
Their religion, too, they believed in providence very strongly.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, well, there was an interesting part in the thing. They eventually married, both of them, late in life. And was it Agnes who married first?
Margaret.
Margaret. Yes. And mm-hmm. her husband died.
Mm-hmm.
They traveled.
Mm-hmm.
And then Agnes married. Her husband died. They traveled.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting, the seminal, if you will, journey to St. Catherine's. She was aware that if her sister hadn't married the first time, when she did, they would have gone ahead that time to St. Catherine's, and it would have been a wholly different experience. Why is that?
Well, they did believe in Providence, and this was a great thing, why they were never afraid, even in storms at sea, because they believed, for instance, that God knows the hour of your death.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they interpreted it, it sounds a bit morbid, but the way they interpreted it is, well, if you're going to die, you're going to die, and if you're not, you're not. And so, don't worry about it. And this, I think, what they did, a lot of it was really very dangerous. It was not dangerous with bandits, but dangerous with a small infection or cholera or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Carried many of these travelers away. But I think they had hoped to go earlier. They had always wanted to go to St. Catherine's, and they had planned an earlier trip. But Margaret was then married, and her husband put his foot down. Well, Agnes and a friend got as far as the Suez Canal, and he said, go no further, it's dangerous. And it was dangerous just a few years before. The professor of Arabic from Cambridge University had been murdered in the Sinai. So, he wasn't mm-hmm. speaking unjustly.
I believed him.
But then after that, when Agnes's husband died, after a sadly all too brief marriage, they moved to Cambridge where, when Margaret's husband died, they moved to Cambridge where Agnes married. And in Cambridge, her husband was a classic scholar, but he was also a keeper of a library with a lot of ancient manuscripts. And they kind of got into the world of ancient texts and manuscripts, and they were in an academic world such as they'd never been in before through him. Agnes's husband was a great antiquary and a collector of old coins. He collected old shekels and carved gemstone rings from Roman times, and he used to go to places like Constantinople to buy them. So he was an experienced traveler, and I think they just learned so much. So when they finally set out after the second husband died, they knew so much more mm-hmm. about what you needed to do to even get access to the monastery, because many travelers were turned away from being able to see the library in St. Catherine's. And they also, in that time, Agnes had learned Syriac, and she had secured a letter from the vice chancellor of Cambridge University, impressively stamped with the university's seal, saying, Mrs. Lewis is a respected person and should be welcomed by you. So they viewed this as a kind of providence, that they'd been thwarted at their earlier trip. I mean, their lives were not without thwartings. They had mm-hmm. a lot of thwartings. But they somehow always believed that it would work out in the end, and in some way probably more marvelous than they had imagined in the first instance. And in their case, this seemed to be true.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Janet Soskis. She is the author of The Sisters of Sinai, How Two Lady Adventurers Discovered the Hidden Gospels. Janet, they had, during this period before this trip, they learned about the fact that there might still be more to discover at St. Catherine's.
They did. Agnes, who had just lost her husband, read that there were a Quaker scholar had visited recently, and he said that there were manuscripts in Syriac that hadn't been examined, and this really fired her imagination. She didn't know much about Syriac, but she knew that it was the language of Jesus and the disciples, and she thought, maybe you might even find the original of Mark's Gospel. Mark's Gospel was thought at that time, maybe it had been written in Syriac. You know, who knows what might be lying there in this monastery, which over, you know, the monastery building itself is 1600, you know, there's been a monastery there, or there's been monks there for probably 1800 years, and monastery for since the 6th century, the present monastic buildings. And over these centuries, after the Vatican, the Monastery of St. Catherine's has the largest collection of manuscripts in the world.
Pretty amazing. It's like, what the heck is it doing there in the middle of the desert? I mean,
and
not even in the middle of the desert, tucked between a couple mountains.
Yeah, it really is remote. And of course, the reason it's there is because of the Moses story. Mm-hmm. And it was famous. Now, whether that actually was the mountain of Moses, who knows? But it was certainly venerated.
Mm-hmm.
And the legend is that, and it may be true, that Helena, the mother of Constantine, went there and founded a church. There was certainly a church there from very, very early on, and the site was identified. There's a spring there, and it was identified with the spring where Moses had met his wife. And so this was a very ancient site. And the wonderful thing about it is that, you know, again, writing the book, mm-hmm. there are pilgrim accounts going right back. The earliest pilgrim account is from the 4th or 5th century, and it's from a woman called St. Egeria, who went out. And her account of going out there by camel is pretty, you know, pretty similar to Agnes and Margaret's to some extent. But it was, you know, it was remote. But, of course, why did so many manuscripts end up there? The monks would move from monastery to monastery. They would become, there are monasteries. Remember that Christianity, before the rise of Islam, Christianity was all over what is now Turkey, all the way to Iraq and Iran. Those are Christian countries.
Mm-hmm.
And across North Africa, you know, very sadly, we're seeing the extinction of this Eastern Christianity now, just in our last decade, the Christian communities in you know, Iraq being really eliminated. But all these, and the monks would travel between monasteries, and they would carry manuscripts with them. And then, of course, when persecutions arose, and they did, you know, in the 7th century with the rise of Islam, monks would flee, and they would take manuscripts with them. And Sinai, because it was just so remote, and, of course, very dry,
mm-hmm.
so it turned out to be a fantastic place for manuscripts because it was too remote to be pillaged, and it was dry enough to preserve the manuscripts and keep them free from, this, you know, rodents, which was another great, rodents are another great danger to manuscripts.
The 60 Minutes recently aired a program about the extinction of the Eastern Christians, but part of that, they had some fantastic footage of St. Catherine's, and the library there now looks very modern, actually, and kind of sealed. And but back in the day, of the sisters, it was pretty basic.
Well, library is almost a misnomer for what it was. What they had is a lot of books.
Yeah.
And we're talking
just
about
laying around.
They had printed books, but they had manuscripts, the handwritten books, and some would be in monk cells, some would be in the church for use, some were in the archbishop's lodgings. There was a library, but it was only very randomly cataloged, and some, like derelict or damaged manuscripts, would just be stuffed in various glory holes that no one even knew they were there, sort of thing. So it was all over the place and not cataloged, and of course, the real danger, a lot of things were being stolen because from the time of Tischendorf, a lot of people, Bible adventurers, you might begin to call them, have been exploring these Eastern monasteries looking for these lost treasures. And there was intense public interest in these, you can imagine, because there were debates going on.
Right.
19th century is an age of doubt being cast on the authority and originality of Scripture and so on. And a lot of things were being stolen because basically Western academics didn't have much, you know, they didn't have much regard for these Eastern monks. They didn't think that they were educated enough to keep all these treasures. Von Tischendorf certainly did. He wrote very dismissive things about the monks who were so kind to him. And so things were being stolen. And, you know, that was a real danger. That's why the monks didn't want people to come and look at their things because they were worried about thieves.
Yeah, dumb is as dumb does. But the sisters had a great relationship as well with the monks, including the priory.
Yes, they did. They The monks had liked this Quaker scholar, Rendell Harris, who the twins had given the twins the tip-off about the Sirach manuscripts, and they liked Agnes and Margaret because Agnes and Margaret could speak Greek, and I think they could just see that Agnes and Margaret were patently nice people and so on. Where this came, after the twins made this find, Rendell Harris had said they had to take a camera, early days of photography, they had to take a camera if they found anything to photograph. So they had taken a huge number of photographs of this and other manuscripts, but about 400 of this manuscript. They didn't know if they would come out. They only before they went had ever taken two successful photographs, and photographing a palimpsest, how would that be? Mm-hmm. And when they got back to Cambridge, they had a really difficult time getting any of the scholars to look at their photographs.
Yeah, because they weren't...
Well, they had no credentials.
Right.
I mean, they were at this time, okay, they knew some languages, but they were just middle-aged, just widows, just Scottish, just president. You know, they were sort of outside all the magic circles of a very stuffy and proud university, you might say, even though it's still my university. So I think the scholars just thought, oh, God, the holiday snaps. I don't want to see them. And when they finally, by trickery, it really got one of the young scholars to look at them.
That's
really
kind of a fun story, though. They invited, they had some people over for dinner, and they said, come on over and check out the piano or something like that. And they had the pictures laid out there.
Yeah, they said, I'm sure you'll want to see our photographs. And they had them laid out on the grand piano. And he had no excuse because the rest of the dinner guests would have thought he was a terrible man if he hadn't looked at them.
Yeah, we've all been through the film strip thing.
And then, of course, the scholars, nothing with the top secrecy, and they had to go out and make another expedition. Well, Agnes and Margaret weren't about to be left behind on this. And anyway, they were the ones who knew the monks and so on. And there, their friendship with the monks was very important. But, of course, it caused a lot of resentment with the scholars because the scholars still regarded the twins as sort of upstarts and having no place in this whole thing.
And then the scholars started to bicker among themselves about who, and kind of left them the sisters completely out of it at one point. And they were, it's kind of interesting. The divisiveness probably was their ruin. But the sisters were very persevering people.
Well, they were, because when the scholars, well, there's a lot of twists in this tale, but when the scholars really tried to cut them out of this, it was agreed that Agnes could write an introduction to the edition they were producing, but it was obviously supposed to be a kind of interesting traveler's tale. You know, that it was supposed to, and I think they wanted to very much the impression given that here were two wealthy and bold ladies who happened to find a manuscript, much in the way that a child at the beach turning over a rock finds an interesting crab or something like that. But Agnes said, no, you know, she hadn't just found it that way. She had learned Sirach purposely. She saw it was a palimpsest. She, you know, she could read it. She thought it was really important, and she didn't want to be. She didn't think she was the world's greatest scholar, but she didn't want to be made a kind of a curious footnote. And because the scholars tried to push them out, Agnes had already rashly committed herself to doing an English translation of this thing. They had both of them to throw themselves into the study of Sirach, and within a couple of years, studying Sirach ferociously, effectively equipped themselves with PhD knowledge, really good knowledge, so that when the thing came out and Agnes was the overall editor, you know, it was such a risk, because if there'd been any flaws in it, it was looked forward to by the public with expectation because of the excitement of two ladies finding it. And if the publication had been amateurish, they would have been absolutely a laughingstock, but it wasn't. And so what it meant for Agnes and Margaret is this kind of, again, here's this the kind of thing they would regard as providence. It didn't feel good to be shut out by the scholars, but because they'd been shut out, they had to acquire the knowledge themselves. They did, and this whole new world, then they were really global scholars and really respected. Everyone was writing to them, and they had the foothold to go out and do further investigations and tours and discovery of manuscripts, which they did until they were in their 70s.
To take a quick break again, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, George Lucas, the man behind Star Wars, has a new book out, a book that looks at the biggest movies in show business history. It's called George Lucas's Blockbusting, and we'll talk to him about movies large and small. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Art Scene continues on WOSU TV tonight at 7:30. Go behind the scenes at Ballet Met's The Nutcracker. See the high art of quilts at its newest exhibition at the Rife Gallery. And get to know the artists of soul art from the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center. Watch Art Scene this Wednesday tonight at 7:30 on WOSU TV. 22 degrees in downtown Columbus, on our way to a high of 25. Cloudy skies today and a chance of some light snow. Clouds tonight and a low of 17. And then snow is likely on Thursday. A snow accumulation of 2 to 4 inches is expected throughout the day and into the evening on Thursday. A high for tomorrow of 25 and a low for Thursday night of 17. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Janet Saskis. She is the author of The Sisters of Sinai, How Two Lady Adventurers Discovered the Hidden Gospels. Janet, you're a professor in philosophical theology at the University of Cambridge and a fellow of Jesus College. Knowing that, I wasn't surprised that you wrote the book, but you came upon the story sort of by accident.
Well, I did, really. I was very interested in Sinai myself, and I went, one of my graduate students said to me, oh, Janet, you're always talking about it. We must go. And so she organized. We went to a group of students and my children were young at that time. And it's still, it's a very magical place.
St. Catharines?
Oh, yes. And it's still very remote and wonderful. I mean, it isn't, the library may have looked modern from the film you saw, but basically the buildings are still the ones built by the Emperor Justinian and these very, very ancient, the most ancient icons and mosaics in the world, really. It's a very magical place. And when I came back from there, I guess I was talking around about it, and I found that people said, well, of course you've heard of Mrs. Gibson and Mrs. Lewis, which I hadn't. But these two ladies, who were the twins, had founded the Presbyterian College in Cambridge for training Presbyterian ministers. And I'd been in that place a number of times, and they have over the end of their dining hall these two portraits, looks like two paintings of the same person, women in academic gowns. And I'd just never known the story, so I became interested in the story, which seemed to me such an amazing, what they did. It would be amazing for anyone to do that even now, but with the disadvantages they had, you know, not having this formal university education, having to break in, the adventures of the travel, but then the equal adventures with the academy, the Stuffy Academy, they weren't even allowed to you go in the university library or to borrow books from the university library or anything like that. So it was just an interesting story all round when I got into it.
How did you decide that it was worth a book?
I don't know, really. There's sometimes that just things just click with you. I'd been interested in the 19th century, and I thought the whole story, you know, now we have a lot of interest in the Middle East, and it's very interesting that prior to the beginning prior to about 1799, Europeans and Americans weren't at all really interested in what we now call the Middle East, Eastern Mediterranean. I mean, in Britain, all the focus was on India on one hand, and on America, the great trading partners. But then Napoleon in 1799, out of the blue, invaded Egypt and made it evident that whoever controlled Egypt controlled the India trade, which was the lifeblood of Britain at the time. Because if you controlled Egypt, you could harass the British trading ships. And so after that, there's this intense sparring about the control of the Eastern Mediterranean, the Russians, the French, the Germans, which goes on today in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this period, a very exciting period, where a lot of political transformation in the Ottoman Empire, which is collapsing, and you have the first growth of, you've got middle-class Americans and British people, Protestants, who for the first time have the money and the wherewithal and the time to go and do exotic travel like this. Because before, you know, Catholics and Greek Orthodox used to go to Jerusalem as pilgrims, but the Protestant travelers weren't going as pilgrims. They didn't approve of holy sites in the same way. But they were going to see Bible lands. And so this was very exciting and fitting in with enormous discoveries in Egyptology and so on. So it's these overlapping layers of Egyptology and Eastern history and politics and science. It all seemed to come together, and I just thought it was so nice to go through this terrain with a couple of ladies who were amateurs. They weren't professional anything, but very gifted and who came triumphantly to have such a marvelous life.
It is an amazing woman's history story as well. We have an email from a listener. Weren't these two young ladies pursuing fashionable academic interests that were otherwise closed to them because women were not admitted to universities in that era? If I recall correctly, the Grammarian Brothers Grimm financed some of their philological
Correct.
Research. Okay. By publishing the folk stories they had collected along the way. If you want to study dialects, one way to do it is to get the old folks in the village to relate their traditional stories in the local dialect. Okay, I give up. What does philological mean?
Well, it just means the study of grammar and languages and so on. And yes, if it was, that's a wonderful email, and it was indeed, especially later in their life when they were doing it, that was indeed part of the motivation. I think initially, they learned the language because they wanted to travel. And I think even when they went to Sinai, I think they thought it would be wonderful, great fun if they found something. But I don't think they imagined in a million years that they would themselves become scholars. It was really because the academics tried to push them out of the boat, as it were, that they had to stir themselves up and became scholars. And then in their later life, they were, at first, their early interest was very strictly to do with scripture and the scriptures that they knew, but they soon found that very important were other things like the folk stories that your emailer mentions, that these gave marvelous insights. For instance, one of the great discoveries of this time was the discovery of the rock tombs at Amarna, and that is the capital city built by the famous Tutankhamun and his wife Nefertiti. And this is very famous to many people because this was the lost pharaoh, and he had tried to change the religion from being having many gods to just the one god, and he built a new capital. And carved on the wall of this tomb they discovered in the 1890s a psalm from the Old Testament. But, you know, the psalm in praise of the one god. But the point is that it had been carved there on the wall of this tomb many, many hundreds of years before people thought the Psalms were written. Most people thought the Psalms had been written by King David. And really, although the jury's still out to some extent, the feeling now is the Emperor Akhenaten wrote this poem, and it was copied by various Middle Eastern scribes, and it made its way into the Old Testament as a psalm. But it's originally an Egyptian hymn to God. So these kinds of discoveries were very exciting to people, and of course rather shaking in some ways. But it was an exciting world that they were moving into.
If you have a question or comment for Janet Saskis, author of The Sisters of Sinai, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Clovis, you're on the air. You want to talk about, you know, a little bit more about the literature that they discovered.
Yes, I do. I'm a late dialer in, so I didn't catch all the program. But I'm very interested in the text that they had found. Does it confirm biblical history? Is it something that's additional? And if so, tell me about it, please.
Oh, great question. Thank you very much. Well, first of all, it's very early. It's from the late 4th century, and that puts it very early. The earliest physical manuscript we have, Gospels, is the Codex Sinaiticus, which is from the early 4th century. But the one that the twins discovered was the earliest Syriac one. And what was interesting about this is they could tell, again, the scholars could tell from the language used, from the nature of the Syriac itself, that the translation that it carried must have been from the 2nd century. And this pushed the dating of the Gospels. And the Gospels presented together as just four Gospels back to very early, to about 190 Because some people, like Thomas Paine, had been saying, oh, the Gospels have been written, you know, many decades, maybe even centuries after the events of Jesus and his disciples. But during this period, the dating was being pushed further back. And there was also a question, how early did the four Gospels begin to circulate together as preeminent? That was, and it was important in establishing that. It was also, it was substantially, the manuscript they discovered is substantially the four Gospels as we know them. One difference is that the Gospel of Mark ends rather abruptly with the women discovering the empty tomb. And this had been noted in other early manuscripts, but no one was quite sure whether the end of Mark had fallen off or been eaten by rats or whatever. Did it really end at this early stage without resurrection appearances? And the manuscript that Agnes and Margaret discovered did more or less prove that the earliest circulations of the Gospel of Mark had that shorter ending. Now, Agnes and Margaret, of course, were very keen. They were conservatives, and they were very keen to think that their find vindicated the authenticity of the New Testament, or the Gospels, rather, as we know them, and it really did to a very large extent. There was one quirky thing. Whoever it was, whether the scribe or the school he belonged to, had tried to get rid of the virgin birth rather unsuccessfully, and had very much tried to suggest that Joseph was the biological father of Jesus. But this seems to be a scribal change from the original.
Clovis, did that help?
Oh, thank you very much. That's very interesting. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
We don't have a lot of time left, maybe about 6 or 7 minutes, but I wanted you to talk about the Codex Sinaiticus, discovered by Constantin von Tischendorf in St. Catharines. There's developments, recent developments. This is an ongoing story.
Well, it really is, because, again, something that came as a shock to people in the 19th century, the Bibles that everyone knew, the King James Version and so on, were based on manuscripts that were really medieval. You know, they were 12th, 13th century. The earliest physical manuscripts anyone knew of for the Bible were not very old. And there was rumored to be a very ancient manuscript in the Vatican, but no one but a couple of cardinals could have access to it, so no one knew. And this fellow, Constantin von Tischendorf, again, a young man in his 20s, went out on a great to look to tour, first of all, the libraries of Europe, and then he discovered the oldest manuscripts he was looking at seemed to be from Eastern monasteries. So he began a tour of Eastern monasteries and discovered the Codex Sinaiticus, which, dating from the early 4th century, and really it was not just the New Testament, it was like the Gospels, the Epistles, the Old Testament, really more or less complete, in a wonderful Greek hand from the early 4th century, which is just about the time that Christianity is made legal by the Emperor Constantine. And this was, you know, this was about 700 years old than the next oldest copy of the Bible. So imagine what an impact it was. This was in, and he kept this very secret where he had found it at first. It was quite a stirring story, but people said if a new island had been discovered, scholars couldn't have been more amazed. Mm-hmm. And so then, and not all of it were there. Obviously, this manuscript, which was truly regal, it must have cost a fortune to produce it. Some bits over the years had fallen away, and then at the time of von Tischendorf, he took some bits and took them to Leipzig, and then he wanted at all costs to get it away from the monks because he didn't believe they were proper stewards of it, despite the fact they'd held the thing safely for 1,500 years. And he got the patronage of the Tsar. He somehow, this Lutheran Protestant, got the patronage of the Tsar and managed to sort of secure it and take it to Petersburg, where it lay. But after the revolution, Stalin was in need of hard currency, so he offered to sell it to the British government, and that's what happened. In the 1930s, the British people bought this manuscript, which is in the British Library. But the new instance, this means that bits of it are all over, because about 20 years ago, part of the wall of the Monastery of St. Catherine's fell down, and they discovered a room that had been blocked in, and it contained some fragments of this ancient codex. So some were in Petersburg, some were in Leipzig, most of it was in London. And this year, for the first time, this oldest copy, it's not only the oldest copy of the Bible, it's probably the oldest book in the world, because moving over from scrolls to books just happened at this time. It's just been published for the first time online. It's, you know, it's interesting. The oldest book in the world has had to be published electronically, and in the course of this summer, they discovered even more fragments in St. Catherine's Monastery that were the pieces of vellum had been used to rebind other books, and they found some fragments of this. So the finds do go on, and of course, people continue to find ancient manuscripts in unexpected places. They turn up in family homes in suburban Washington, D.C., and, you know, people may have family Bibles that are manuscripts, and they turn up in old libraries, they turn up in all kinds of strange places. So this is not a finished story.
Mm-hmm. Alex, you're on the air. You had a question about dating systems.
Yes, I just wanted to know, how do we know that that the Egyptians didn't get the information from reading something from David, you know, because I heard it earlier. And one final question, what do you think about the research that came from James Strong, Dr. James Strong, from known for his exhaustive concordance? That's pretty much it. Thank you. I'll take the answer off the air.
Thank you, Alex.
I wasn't quite sure about that James Strong question, but about the previous one, there's a lot of debate about this still. But we do know we can date Amarna and Akhenaten very accurately through the legends and through the pharaonic history. And it just seems that this is a lot earlier than the dating that we would give to most of the Psalms. Again, the dating of the Psalms have different dates. Scholars now don't think that they're all, and some may be written by King David, but they're written, some of the Psalms are clearly very ancient. Some of the Psalms appear to be the most ancient parts of the Bible. But they can tell, again, from the Hebrew, they can make a good guess at when these were likely to have been written. And, you know, again, it's an interesting story to follow up in footnotes from my book. But it's just, although there's an element of debate here, it seems very likely that this actually was written by Akhenaten. We now know that a lot of poetry and even legend would be copied by scribes. For instance, at various stages, the Egyptians ruled the whole, all the way up to Turkey, and scribes would go back and forth with things, and they'd go back with diplomatic documents, but they'd go back with poetry and verse as well, and that just seems to be the best guess at the moment.
We only have about 30 seconds, Janet, but I wondered, the sisters received honorary degrees, no doubt, but they didn't from Cambridge?
No, never.
What? What a shame.
I know.
Is there just a rule against that, or?
Well, there were, yes. I mean, the first degree of any sort given to a woman at Cambridge was in, after the Second World War, it was given to the Queen Mother, the mother of the present Queen, who by any accounts is not a very great intellectual, but there you go. It's not a very bright star in the horizon of Cambridge University.
Yes, but you are there, and we appreciate you taking the time to spend to talk about your book today. It's Janet Soskis. She's the author of The Sisters of Sinai, How Two Lady Adventurers Discovered the Hidden Gospels. Thanks again, Janet.
Thank you so much.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820. Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from City Music, presenting Helen Welch and her jazz trio in conjunction with the Jazz Arts Group, Sunday, January 10th at the Athletic Club of Columbus. Tickets available at citymusiccolumbus.com.